Hi. This is Eleanor Sander, and I'm here with Thelma Johnson, and we're going to talk a little bit about Thelma's life in Kodiak or in Alaska. Thelma, you were born here. Where were you born?
Was born here in Kodiak, yeah.
Where was the hospital?
Oh, there wasn't a hospital. I was born at home, and we had a midwife, and I really don't remember where home was. I don't remember which house it was. I've probably known in the past years, but Kodiak has changed so much, not only since, at that time, but all through the years.
So you didn't have a doctor, so you just had your children, and how many were in your family?
Well, at that time, I had two older sisters, and I came along, and I think Dad was quite disappointed because here's another girl.
And who was your father and mom?
Charles Madsen.
Charles
And
Madsen.
my mother, Mary Madsen, who was also born here in Kodiak.
Well, I know one of your brothers, Roy. That's the only brother that I know who became a judge here and.
Well, he was the child that was born the year and a half after I was, and he was the boy that Dad had been waiting for. So that was the exciting time.
And
and
your mom passed away when you were
yeah,
held.
I was six.
You were
Six,
six.
Roy was five, and we had, well, there was another sister after Roy was born, and she was, I think, just 6 months old when our mother passed away. But Dad hired housekeepers. It's been at least 7 years before he remarried, so he was both mother and father, and really great. And we had good housekeepers and had a real good life, I think. Because the people that took care of us, we knew it was a small town, and of course, they were young ladies, and at that time that we didn't have a high school, I don't believe, so they were out of school, and we just needed a job.
Oh, you didn't have a high school here.
Not till a few years later, because I know when my oldest sister Elizabeth went to school, they had just started high school.
And is that in the location where the current high school is?
Oh, no.
No.
We went to school, school right down in the middle, right about where those Marine View apartments are. In fact, the school was there at the time of the earthquake and tidal wave, and the Salif came tearing through town and landed right beside that school.
Oh, so the school system was like where the Harborview apartments are located now,
I
Cashewero.
went to first and second grade in an old schoolhouse, and then by the time I was in third grade, they had built this new one, and I went from third through 12th in that building, which.
And then the tidal wave came through, and the Salif came up by the high
Right
school.
beside that high school, and they used that school for a while, but in the meantime they had started building them. Well, they had already built some of the other schools because my children went to the new schools around here. But at that time, that was the school.
Right.
And my graduating class consisted of six people at that time.
How fun. And
all
do you
classes
still
were
have
small.
reunions?
Well, there's just two. There are two of us that live here in Kodiak, Neil Sargent and myself. One girl lives in California, and the other three have passed away. Six of us. So we have had reunions up for several years. I graduated in 39, so they'd have everyone from 36, which I think was the first graduating class, up through the 60s, because there were so few graduates in each class, and they would just combine them.
Kodiak's changed a lot since you were born here.
Very much so.
And what do you think could changed it the most? You know, was it just progress or the war coming?
I think it was the war, because after I graduated from high school, I went on to the University of Alaska for 1 year and came back, and it was just at the time that Sims Creek, the contractor, started moving in and we're building the Navy base, and my father had the bright idea of opening up a curio shop. wasn't any place in town where you could buy souvenirs, and I said, my goodness, with all these strange people moving in, and little by little, the military start coming in, so he built this little shop, and I worked for him.
Oh, you did? Okay, yeah. So you went to college, and then you came back.
I went to college and came 39. Back, and went to work for Sears. Sears Roebuck put up a mail order store, and we had, well, one of the only, were there two hotels in town? Well, we had the hotel anyway. And this fellow that came to, that had come from Seattle for Sears, asked my dad if he knew of anyone that he could hire to work for him. And Dad says, yep, I have a girl coming home from college in May. So I stopped in Anchorage and took some training and came on over here. Mm-hmm. And they hired me at Sears, but the thing was I was too young to be the manager, so they hired a lady from whose husband worked at the Navy base and she, for civil service, and so she was the manager, and the two of us worked together, and she was there for 6 months and got sick and sent back to the States, so I ended up taking over the store after all.
And was that close to where your father's store was?
No, it was right, it was down near, was on the street that goes
Center and Center?
It wasn't on Center no. Street, it was down
Shillicoff, down by the boat harbor?
Well, more like
Upper Mill Bay.
No, it was in front of Crafts, whatever the street.
Oh, okay.
Well, right across from the bakery, up in that area.
Okay.
The bakery wall. Mm-hmm.
Like where the theater is today, the Orpheum Theater.
Mm-hmm. Right in that area. Mm-hmm. And of course, after Sears had been there for a while, in moved Montgomery Ward. And they were right across the street from us.
Oh my, so they were both Sears and Wards here.
Yes. Wow. And the girl that was hired to take care of Wards was having a terrible time, so I would go over there and help her, not knowing what competitors Sears and Wards were. And every time she had a problem, she came running over to me, so I'd say, okay, well, I'll be over, I'll take care of you.
Oh, for goodness sakes.
But as time went on, the business at Sears was terrific because they were building a place out at the base called Buskinville, and it was for dependents of civil service workers. And of course they were coming in buying all this knockdown furniture, and we had, Sears said any store or any mail order house that sold most for this quarter would get the bonus. And they sent us these stacks of brochures to pass out. We were so busy we didn't have time to pass those out to anybody or hire children to take them around for us, but we got the bonus every quarter because our business was so terrific due to the Navy moving
to the Navy,
the Buskinville being built.
Well, how did you get your gifts for your shop? On the boat that came in once a month?
When my father started the trading shop.
Was that the same time when you were working at Sears, correct?
Yeah, he started it when I was working at Sears, and then he decided he had to have someone come around his store, so he said, come on, Velma, you give up your job at Sears and come work for me, which I did. And he would go out and buy a lot of this stuff, and he would go up north and get ivory and parkas and hooks and things, also from the Eskimos, because he had lived up north and knew just who and where to get it from.
He lived up north for,
where was he born? In his younger days. He was from Denmark.
He was? Okay. And then he came over
He was born in Denmark and left home very young and sailed around the world. He joined the English Navy or, I'd have to ask my brother why, because we didn't pay much attention to the stories he used to tell us. But he had a very adventurous life and finally ended up in San Francisco, and I guess he came up to Alaska during the Gold Rush days, but decided that wasn't for him, the gold rush thing. So he went up north and traded with the Eskimos instead, and had a very adventurous
life.
Like
up in Nome and Barrow in that area?
In those islands. In fact, he put his story on tape, and they wrote this book, The Arctic Trader, which I have a copy of.
Oh, fun. I haven't read that book. I'll have to read that book, The Arctic Trader.
It's about his life up north.
Oh, how fun.
And he actually lived with the Eskimos, learned their language, and I think he married an Eskimo lady, a chief's daughter, and later they were divorced. And he finally ended up in Kodiak. Not my mother.
Here. Do you know what brought him to Kodiak from up there? Just adventurous or?
No, he's something. Stopped here for some reason. Mm-hmm. I really don't know. Roy knows so much more about it. It's too bad you aren't interviewing him. But somebody already has.
Interesting. The Arctic trader.
Yeah.
So he had contacts of getting all the little items to sell
in
the store.
He has very good contacts. Right. And of course he knew what kind of items would go because he started buying these pillow, satin pillow cases, you know, with a fringe around mm-hmm. them. And they were just like $1.50, and they came with a mailing box, and they were to my sweetheart, to my mother, to my sister, and he bought thousands of those, and they'd come in, and we had this warehouse, and we had to stack those, and we sold them, and all they had to do was buy them and put them in this box and put the address on them, and we would mail them for them.
Oh.
And of course, you know, after the Civil Service came in, then it was the military, the Marines, the Army, the Navy, and at Christmas time, our shop was so small we could only let so many people in at one time, lock the door until we waited on those people and let them out, and it was a terrific business.
Uh-huh. Really how nice. How long did he have this business, and did you work there?
Oh, I worked for him until he decided that it was right after the war. It must have been 43, I think, 40. Things start slowing mm-hmm. down and they mm-hmm. start shipping people back home. And then, of course, I got married and traveled around with Owie.
You met your sweetheart during the war up here right. in Kodiak.
Yes.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Owie Johnson.
From Minnesota. Mm-hmm. He was in the 215th Coast Artillery. When I first met him, he was a second lieutenant. And then he got out of the service. He got out as a major, but we left here and lived in places like Texas and Oklahoma. He stationed at Fort Bliss, Texas, a lot in Oklahoma, and Colorado Springs, Camp Carson. So we did quite a bit of traveling.
You being from here, did you find these places like, were they like adventurous to you, or were they like too much?
Taken my first trip to the States when I was 20 years old. It was the year the war broke out. I had home from college, and I was working for Dad's shop.
1939?
1941. 1941, okay. It was December, just before Christmas. The war broke out December 7th,
right.
1941, and I had a chance to go to the States. In fact, I'd been planning on this trip, so I went anyway, and there was a Alaska Steamship Company, you know, took passengers out, and at that time, they were shipping out all the dependents for the, you know, civil service workers. And so I went out on that same ship, I think it was the Columbia. And we left here, and they had all the windows were painted black. And so we left Kodiak, got to Seward, and some of the passengers got off in Seward. And luckily, I stayed on the ship because in the middle of the night, they sighted a Japanese submarine, so the ship had to pull away from the dock, and the people that were in town got left there, and we just anchored out and came back in at daylight the next morning and picked up those passengers, but I guess they all had to sit in the train depot or wherever they could find
that was a shelter. That was like in the winter you went out.
Yes, it was
right,
December.
Right. Uh-huh. And so then you went from Seward on down to
we
San Francisco?
Seward and we
Seattle?
Stopped in several places along the coast, and I went to Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
I
mm-hmm.
spent my first visit to the States in Seattle. And spent about 2 or 3 weeks there and came back home.
Yeah. So when did you actually come back to Alaska to live?
In 1946, December of 1946, when we got off service, we went to Camp Joseph T. Robinson in Arkansas. And he was separated there, and then we went on to Minnesota, to his home, and spent some time there. And I think we were there for Thanksgiving. We got out in October, and we were there for Thanksgiving, and then came up to Kodiak in December.
Uh-huh.
1946.
So your family was already here, and he'd been stationed here, so you guys wanted to come back, both of
he
you.
He did, yes. Very much. He just decided this was the place he wanted to settle down.
So well, that made you happy. I mean, your family was here, and right.
So then we both found a job. He was an electrician by trade before he got in the service, and I worked at the crafts department store, and we rented a little house. We stayed with my folks for a while, and then rented a little house on Mission Road, and then later bought the house up here on the hill, because Thelma lived across the street. Ole happened to meet him, and Ole was a ham operator. It was his hobby, and so the hams always got together and got acquainted, and this one said, "Oh, Ole, you've got to buy this house up on the hill. It's the best ham location." We didn't have any children. It was a little tiny one-bedroom house, so we did buy it and lived there for a year and realized we were going to have a child.
Oh.
So
you have three children. I guess I only knew two of them.
No, my youngest son lives in Seattle.
Okay, right.
You know, Rita's the oldest, and then Mark works for the fire department. Has his own computer business in Seattle.
So when the tidal wave came, I mean, you all must have thought that it was like just the end of the world or whatever.
Well,
I mean,
we had just come home from Mass. It was Good Friday, and we had all gone to church. I was working at for the airlines at the time, Pacific Northern Airlines, PNA.
Pacific Northern Airlines, okay.
And so we had to come home from Mass, and we had just finished eating dinner, and we had, well, we couldn't eat meat most days, so it was scrambled eggs or whatever. And all of a sudden, everything started shaking, and my youngest son, Chris, said, "Dad, what's happening?" And Holly said, "Oh, nothing, Chris, don't worry about it, it's just an earthquake." Well, it went on, and we looked out, and we could see the wires slapping together, and the sparks flying, and Chris was only about, old was he? 10. And we had the children had a little playhouse outdoors, and one of the neighbor children, a little girl, was down there, and she was hammering a nail in the wall to hang a picture up in the playhouse. And all of a sudden, the door opened, she came crawling in on her hands and knees saying, "I didn't do it, I didn't do it."
Oh, bless her heart.
In the meantime, the chandelier was hitting the ceiling, the doorbell chimes were clanging, and the place was really shaking. And we said, "Get down on your hands and knees." So I said, get down on your knees, let's start saying the Hail Marys, which we did. Well, we finally got to the door, and we didn't dare go out. It looked like the hills were rolling, and the wires were slapping together, and there was fire flying and everything. And then, of course, all the lights went out, and only thing had the manager, K.A., he had to take off, so he left, and Mark went with him. Well, then, Chris and I were at home, and we were doing up the dishes, and we'd go out the window, and Chris said, "Mother, come look out the window." He said, "The tide is way, way out." We didn't have the radio on. We didn't think about a tidal wave or anything. Half an hour after the earthquake had finally quit. So I went and I said, "My, isn't that strange? I wonder what's going on." And I came back into the kitchen finally, "Mother, come quick, the tide's back in again." So that was the first wave that
it's here.
And then we saw Mark. He left KA and he came running home. Of course, we can see everything from here. He came running home. He looked like a little gingerbread man, you know, just running as fast as he could go. And, of course, we didn't see Ole for quite a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And later that evening, the MPs and the police came and said, "Get to higher ground." And I said, "Oh, no." And as Ole left, he said, "Stay here. You're safe, no matter what happens." So when they came, they said, "No, get up, get to higher ground." And I said, "Well, my husband said to stay here." And they said, "Get out." So we had to take our boots and put our coats on. We started up the hill, this big tree where the children always played. And as we were going up, the lady who lived up above us, she had several children, and her husband was in Seattle at the time. It was Pat Bonney, her husband's famous pigs.
That's right.
And she had this little basket of puppies. So we stopped and helped her with her children and helped with the basket of puppies, and all of us went up to this big tree and sat under the tree, and one of my boys, I think, brought the radio along, and then we realized what was happening. We heard about Seward and Valdez, and we just didn't know what to think. So we stayed up there for quite some time, and then Ole managed to come home from KA, and the house was full of people, and he walked in and he said, "Where's my family?" Mm-hmm. And somebody that he didn't know said, "Oh, do you live here?" Because they were taking people from lower ground and saying, "Get higher ground," and everybody's houses were open, you know, and they could just go in anywhere that, you know, they could find shelter. So he was out on the road there yelling for me and saying, "Alma, Alma, come on down." So the children and I and my neighbors, we finally all went, came on down, you know, and felt that we'd be safe at home.
So how long then during all this time, I mean, what kind of time frame was it? You didn't have any lights, you didn't have any water.
With the earthquake, and then 6 o'clock, I think the first wave came in, and I think the last one must have come in around 2:30 in the morning. We couldn't see it because it was so dark, but it did come up as far as the police station at that time.
Goodness.
In the meantime, I got up the next morning, we looked out here, everything was just a shambles, you know, the boats had come up through there and just knocked everything down in there.
Your community had been devastated overnight.
Oh,
so.
Yes, and I looked up and I thought, gosh, they'll never ever be able to put this back together again. Mm-hmm. I thought, surely, you know, we'd have to pick up a move. Yeah, but then there was the problem of the electricity. They were afraid there were live wires all over, and of course there was a lot of displaced people. A lot of them stayed up on Pillar Mountain, you know, and just slept in their cars, and then they had places roped off, and of course the Marines were in, and they, even way back then, they were afraid of looting, which I don't think there would have been too much of that, because everybody just seemed to be so upset and trying to help
each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So.
And then the ash, I mean, that must have fallen from the, different paragraph. when the mountain blew.
That was way before my time.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
It's like 1912.
Yes, yes.
I was born in 1921.
Right.
So all I have seen is pictures of
that. Your father, though.
He wasn't here at the time.
He was up north. Was he up north with the Eskimos at that time? Yeah.
And my stepmother was, oh, she was so very young, I don't think she remembered it, so she didn't tell us very much about it.
Yeah. It's just so strange, you know, you can dig and you find feet of ash, just lots of it, yeah.
Well, that book that they sell at the museum, I think it only comes with all her ashes and water, and of course the first half is about the volcanic eruption, and the second half is about the title.
Yeah. Ashes and Water, what a good name. Mm-hmm. Well, you worked here in the museum.
I volunteered there.
Mm-hmm. So, is there anything in your life growing up or, you know, that is just so unforgettable or that you just can't?
Well, that was a very impressionable thing, the earthquake.
Of course.
I was still working at the airlines and went back to work this happened on Friday, and I guess I went back to work on Saturday because everybody was lining up trying to get passage to get out of
here.
And then that following Tuesday, there was a tremor that was almost, you know, it was much more violent even than the earthquake.
Oh, really?
And I happened to be in the PNA office waiting on a customer, and he had neon lights up on the ceiling, and this one woman, all of a sudden, this thing hit, and this woman, he let out this yell, and one of the girls that I was working with, she went hysterical. That's really, of course, everybody's so nerved up, you know, from the big one. But for some reason, I was able to keep calm.
In your father's store, was it taken away?
Oh, he had already given that up.
He had, okay.
He'd already gone off of business and was back in his honey business.
He was. Yeah.
So, just when he sold out, he realized that things were tapering off.
Was that right after the war, like 46, 47, 48?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Then he went back into hunting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Because he had to give it up during the war, because the old areas were, you know, restricted.
Mm-hmm.
Only was in charge of searchlight and radar positions.
Well, so how did you and Ole meet?
Well, let's see. One of the girls that worked in the store met this fellow. She met him, and she was dating him for a while, and she said, he said to her, I've got a friend that I'd like to introduce him to Alma, because I've met this friend first. So he brought Ole in and introduced him to me, and Ole asked if he could take me to dinner or something. So, well, yeah, the only place unless my dad meets the person, and I have to have dad's okay. So we had a little office in the store, and I took him in there, and I said, oh, Dad, this is some... So then I sat down and had a little visit with him and said, well, yes, but he said, Thelma must be in at 11 o'clock. I was 19 years old, but I still have to be in at 11 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And Ole said, well, that's no problem. We're just going off to dinner and dance. And we went out and had a good time. He got me only 11 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
And then I was still dating other men, and he'd come by, and we'd have another date. And one of the dates, I said, I asked him how old he was or something. And he told me, and I said, my gosh, you're the oldest man I've ever gone out with. Years older than I was. But it so happened we had so much in common. He'd gone through Boy Scouts and I had gone through the Girl Scouts. He'd been Boy Scout leader and we loved the outdoors. And whenever we had a date, this one time he came in to pick me up and I had packed us a picnic lunch. And he said, what are we doing today? And I said, oh, we're going for a hike. And I said, I've got us a picnic lunch. So he said, oh, great. So we walked out towards Manosca because there was just a trail. There was many roads out there. It was a beautiful day. We sat down to have our picnic lunch. And I said, what did you do this morning? Or he said, oh, I had to go on a 20-mile hike with a pack.
Oh, and here you took him out hiking.
Oh, God, I took him out hiking. He didn't object. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, for you, being a young lady at that time with all these men on the island, I mean, it must have been kind of exciting, you know? It was like, Yahtzee.
Well, the thing was, we all had to join this USO group, and we got invitations. All the different outfits would, in fact, I had scrapbook, they would make up their invitation to a dance. Like sometimes we had to go by boat to Long Island, and we'd go, you know, when it was light, and they would have the whole dock decorated, and they'd have excellent music because so many of it, they were named bands, people that were in the service. And we'd dance, but we had a lot of Mrs. Erskine, Frosty Johnson, you know, so they were our chaperones. We had some grown up chaperones, and they were very well. Run dances, and we just danced at our refreshments, and we came home. And that was practically every weekend, every week for weeks on end.
Must have been very exciting, even though there was a war
going
on. It was
fun, and you met a lot of very nice people, and really there was, you know, we didn't actually date the boys. We met them, but they would, we'd meet them, and they all came into the shop, and they'd visit a bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, it would be enough to make a young girl's heart flutter for sure, huh?
Yeah, it's really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Exciting and fun because we all love to dance.
The tape continues at number 128.
So you don't have to put that in the report.
No. But isn't that fun? A fun time, you know,
it's
exciting.
Fun time, and golly, none of us girls smoked. None of us drank. We loved to dance. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was a jitterbug at that time. And,
oh, yes.
And they would have contests, you know, and my sister Austin and I would, well, all the girls here, you know, we'd all get a prize or something. It was just plain. Good fun.
Good fun.
It was good morale boosters. Mm-hmm. Good service. Mm-hmm.
So Ole was stationed here, and imagine the whole bay. I mean, you can see leftovers, you know, from the bunkers and old roads and everything. And where exactly was he located on the island?
He had to go on here at Chahafka, well, beyond that, Beachcombers, and had to go around the island quite a bit, several places. It was kind of secret, so, and I never questioned him, so
right.
I really don't know, but I would look up and I'd see those searchlights, and I'd say, that's one of Ole's boys, you know, and he had, in fact, before he came up here, it was a real hush-hush thing. He went through radar school. They were just starting that, you know.
Oh, yes, right.
Yeah. So. He had several positions, and he would have to go and check on his men, then he would have to go every payday and pay them, and he had to carry all this currency, you know, actual cash, and count it off and pay them off.
Because there were no banks here.
Yeah, we did have a bank.
At that time? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Because that came during the
bank
war or
before
the war?
It had started just before the war. The Bank of Kodiak, it was called. In fact, my dad went and opened a savings account for each one of us. Mine was number 4.
Oh,
the banker's daughter had number 1.
Uh-huh.
And I kept this for a long time. And then, of course, when it, you know, when they got bigger, they said, well, that's not worth anything.
Uh-huh.
Got one of those 5-digit numbers.
Right, but you were number 4. How fun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think I still have the little bank book somewhere.
Kodiak's changed a lot.
It really has, very much. But in a way, a lot for the better after the earthquake and tidal wave, because so many of those buildings were frame buildings, you know, and they were all kind of lined up together on the one street. Mm-hmm. Drugstore and City Market, this and if they'd ever had a fire, the whole block could have gone.
You know, the whole town.
The whole town could easily.
Is Sutliff's where it was before, or is that all that on Shillicoff? Is that all different?
Sutliff's was up where, you know, across from Kodiak Auto Center.
Right. Oh, okay.
That was the original Sutliff's up there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's all that is new, the long way down there. Since the earthquake and tidal, that whole area down near the boat harbor, because it just wiped the boat harbor out completely.
Did all the boats leave? Did they go out?
Went out, and some came back in, and I didn't see all the activity on the water. A lot of people did that could see that, and Ole said you'd see things going by KEA, and pretty soon they were on their way back again.
Oh my.
It was and Kodiak Airways had a place down near KA, and it just took all the planes and everything, you know, up there.
So Kodiak Airways was here, and the major airline was, what did you call it?
PNA, Pacific Northern Airlines.
Pacific Northern, okay.
Which later was, you know, merged with Western.
Mm-hmm. And that airport was where it is today? Now that was a ranch, though, at one point, right? way back.
Years ago.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I forget the name of the rancher.
Siddons.
Hmm?
Siddons?
Could be, yeah. Because they had a picture, I saw a picture of this ranch in front of Barometer. Because that road didn't exist there.
Well,
from the war.
Part of it. Because it was even before the they built the base, they had this road that went along, but the slide, never knew when the slide was going to happen, and sometimes it would just cover the road and it would be closed for a while until they shoveled it out again. And driving back and forth even before the war, when they were building the Navy base, you could come driving along and a great big rock would come rolling down, hit your car. It was really quite dangerous.
Oh, my. Well, was the old Burma Road? Is that what they called that? That
I guess it was
that. It went on top of Pillar Mountain and then around. And
no, that's the one that the military built.
That was their road.
That was so long because the Shelikov Highway, it was called at one time, was the original road from here to the base, and then they later moved it up and rerouted it.
Was the landslide this one downtown that you're talking about, or was there another slide area?
No, it's the main slide area on the after you test the
Sealand.
Sealand.
Yeah, that. Okay, so it must have really been closer to the.
Mm-hmm. Oh yes, it was much closer to the water.
Because that really has moved out since when I got up here in 72. Then they piled cars on top of each other for like a breaker, like a wall to keep the rocks off the road or whatever, which was crushed cars. Very bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah. That was awful. And everyone complained about that. So luckily they changed it to, which I think looks a lot better, is the big stones.
Yeah. Well, this is really interesting, Thelma.
That we had everything worked out, and they put Kodiak back together after the earthquake and tidal wave, and actually in many, many ways it was for the better, things worked out better. And of course the town has kept on growing since then.
How many people were here approximately, do you remember, like in your teens or?
Yeah, 500.
500, right. Mm-hmm. And so you got all your supplies by air or by the boat, the steamer that came in?
Mm-hmm. Once a month, and the stores would go to the store, buy potatoes, be on the next boat, or eggs, or anything. We were just so accustomed of doing without, it didn't seem to bother anybody. We knew it would come on the next boat. And even the Seattle PI, my dad used to buy that. We'd get 4 issues at one time, and of course there were enough of us kids, we all got to read the comic pages, as far as the old news, it didn't seem to make any difference to the people that read the papers, but we did have radio,
You didn't have television?
No, we didn't have television until, my kids are...
I think... See, because in the 70s I got up here and we had Channel 9. That was it.
We had one channel for many years. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But, TV, as far as in a child's eyes, when you didn't have it, you didn't miss it. But you used your imagination, you went on hikes and played. And
we did. Only and I got to head this, he bid on this piece of land at Island Lake. It was not a lottery, it was an auction. Mm-hmm. And he went to this auction, and all we had was $120 in cash. And he said, I'll go bid on that piece of property. And I said, don't go any higher than $120. That's all we have. So he went to the auction, and someone fully opened it for $100 for this acre and a quarter at Island Lake. And Okie Chandler bid 110, and all he said, oh boy, he bid 120, and that was it, that was our money. And Okie Chandler said, oh, let Ole Johnson have it, he's a real good guy. So we got this 1.25 acre of land at Island Lake and built a cabin there.
Oh, well, I'll be.
Well, we started from scratch and he just took down 3 trees because we just didn't want to cut down the trees even if we didn't get all that sunshine. And we'd go out there every weekend and we all worked so hard on that. And there was a carpenter that had also had gotten a loft not too across the lake from us, and he came over to see what Ole was doing one day, and he looked at Ole's foundation. We finally had the foundation post in, and he said, "Oh my God, Ole, what are you going to do? Build a 10-story building?" It was just a little cabin. Uh-huh. And he said, "No, but," he said, "I'd like a good foundation." So, uh-huh. And it was. It'll be there forever, I think.
So what did you do with the property? You still have it?
Well, we built our cabin there, and then another 1.25 acre came up for sale, and Ole was out of town, and I went to the land sale and I put down my 10%, which is $360 or whatever, and I called Ole that night and I said, "Guess what I did," because we usually didn't do anything without talking to each other, and I said, "This property came up right next to our cabin at Island Lake and I bid on it." I said, "I put down a down payment." He said, "Oh, good for you." So we got another piece, and then some more land came up for sale, so we dashed up there and we ended up owning 10 acres. Mm-hmm. And after all, we built our little cabin and we used it so much. It was such a lovely place, and there were more salmon berries there. Mm-hmm. And Island Lake was just a real, you know, a resort place then. People didn't live there the year round. It was just kind of a
summer.
Quiet summer. Uh-huh. Well, not summer, because we'd go across, we got most of our building material across the lake when it was frozen.
Frozen.
We could drive across then. And we'd use it in summer and winter. We'd have skating parties and everything. It was just wonderful. And then little by little, people start moving in there and buying the places up and making, you know, residences out of them for year round. And after Ole passed away, I just felt keep it. We always went by boat or walk this mm-hmm. little trail, and then when they start putting in the water and sewer lines, they ruined most of the property around the lake. So a friend of mine had a place at Chiniac, and she had lost her husband, and she put her place up for sale, so I sold more property at Highland Lake and my place at Chiniac.
I see. Oh, so you have changed places, so to speak.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So do you go out there very often?
Well, we did for a while, and then the pump went bad, and we don't have running water, and then we didn't drain the pipes early enough, and they all froze and broke, and I got a plumber in there to redo them, and the first time we turned the water on, all the joints came apart, and got under the linoleum and actually ruined the place, and then we had this oil stove that I would keep burning, but on low, and burned a little too long and just blew up, and we had soot all over the place.
Oh my.
Another time it took us, well, I had to hire a Waltz cleaning service to clean it. There was not one quarter of an inch that wasn't black in the whole place. We had to throw out the furniture
and
everything, and we finally got it cleaned up. And today I ran into someone that had just been out there visiting the people across the street from me, and he said, "Better get out there. You've got a broken window in your lawn."
Oh.
So I'm throwing a rock up there.
So it's kind of hard to keep up with it.
Yeah.
The kids and their vandalism, or whoever it is, you want to say it's kids, it could be adults, but it's such a sad thing.
Well, it's even
thing.
Little children, because a friend of mine and I were out there one day, and we were sitting there in front of this window that faces the ocean. All of a sudden we hear this ping, and it was right between us, right in the thermal pane window. They shot a BB gun.
Oh, goodness.
And before we knew it, they shot another one, which was in the small window in the loft there. So she ran outdoors, because she's the one on top of the cabin, and she recognized one of the boys. So we jumped in the car then and dashed him to the state troopers and told them all about it and filmed out this thing. Nothing ever happened. I got the Dale Sellers from the glass insurance is $1,000 deductible due to, you know, security.
So that's one part of Kodiak that probably changed that you really, as any of us, don't really enjoy, is the kids or the young adults' attitudes. That when you were growing up, you had a free, wholesome, clean type of an atmosphere, and you just kept everything that way. Everybody mm-hmm. did.
Yeah. Nobody ever locked their doors.
Right.
And because we knew everybody here, and we just, you know, made our own entertainment. In the summer, we picked berries and we climbed Mount Fronder, climbed up Pillar Mountain 4 or 5 times, through the summer. And they had a pond not too far from here, but the kids called it the swimming hole, and they'd go swimming, and they'd go swimming at Big Lake, which is around where Pizza
Hut. Lily Lake, I think they call it today.
And in the wintertime, that froze, and they'd go up there and have skating parties and go water.
Yeah.
It was just mainly outdoor fun. And wherever we went, we had to walk. It was all exercise and fun. We didn't have anything left over for vandalism.
Yeah. I think imagination is something our children were lacking in the 90s and the 80s, basically. They're paid amusement children.
Mm-hmm.
Give me, I want.
It starts with TV,
I think TV is
terrible.
Because
we were the last family on this hill. We lived, the whole neighborhood was families that had children the ages of our children. But we were the last ones to get TV. And our children would say, oh, let me go up to that magazine's are up there. Not unless you're invited, you know. And of course, they always were because they had, well, they had cousins that lived up there and then other friends. And they'd say, come on and watch it, so, such and such a song. Mm-hmm. So we finally were forced to get on TV. But we just had the one channel. And so there was just very little that the children watched. You know, they watched the news. I've never been a TV watcher. So I always got the money. So. And I like to read. And I'm making baskets. And I'm very involved in volunteer work, especially since I've been gone. I was jumped in the ball floors and very, very busy.
Sure. He's been gone now. How many years?
Since 84.
84.
Mm-hmm. Eight.
Yeah.
It'll be 9 years. January.
Well, it's very exciting that you found a man that wanted to come back to your home. And,
that
you can share.
His friends would say, what in the world do you want to live in Alaska for? And always would say, well, one thing, it doesn't get as hot in the summer and it doesn't get as cold in the winter. It's Minnesota.
Minnesota's cold.
Yes, we've been there. We spent Thanksgiving there. It's cold. We've been there in July and it was hot. We've gone back, a number of times because his father was still alive. He was an Alaskan through and through, except for the fact that he didn't like seafood.
He didn't like seafood,
and he thought the worst of all the seafood was salmon and king crab.
Isn't that something? How ironic, living in the king crab capital and not liking it.
Uh-huh.
Then he didn't fish, I take it.
Oh, no.
No, because he didn't enjoy.
And he didn't hunt. He didn't like wild game either. Mm-hmm. But he said he couldn't see killing a deer, and he just wasn't a hunter.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, my father had offered to take him on a bear hunt. He said, only take you on the bear hunt. This must be David. And he said, well, thanks a lot, Mr. Manson, but I just don't like to kill anything.
Good for him.
And all his friends said, you're crazy, you're out of your mind, Charlie Manson, I'm gonna take you on a bear hunt and you turn him down. He said, yeah, that's not one of my things.
Yes. Well, this has been a wonderful chat, and I thank you very much for all your information. You're a very special lady.
Thank you. I'll have something you can put together.